Welcome to I Might Believe in Fairies. I am your host, Aaron Erber. This is a podcast about stories, myths, and the Catholic faith. Hey everybody, welcome to I Might Believe in Fairies. This is Aaron Erber, and after some delay and my being sick for the past like 2.5 days, I am joined by the lead singer. I don't know if you're the lead singer. We'll get to that. Neil DeGrade from Dirt Poor Robins, one of my new favorite bands. I've been listening to you guys for the past probably 1.5 to 2 years. I started when you guys were on the Symbolic World with Jonathan Peugeot, and he played some clips of your music, and I was like, I hadn't listened to music in, I don't know, years, and I was like, oh yeah, music is awesome. It was like pouring, I think I put in my notes something like pouring cool water over a dry desert. I'm like, I didn't know I needed music that badly, but it was, whatever it was, the sound you guys produce or the lyrics, it was just so refreshing and cool, and I was all into that. So I started immediately listening to a bunch of your music for like hours at a time. So it was,
appreciate that.
Yeah, it was like a breath of fresh air. It was awesome. So why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself and give us some of your background, as much detail as you want to provide. And then can I just jump into what we're going to talk about today. I really want to talk about a number of things, but the biggest one is your new silent film / album you put out called Queen of the Nights. But we'll get to that in a little bit. So go ahead and introduce yourself.
Sure. Hi, everyone. I'm Neil DeGrade, and this is an audio-only podcast, so I'm in a very relaxed position recording this. Very, very comfortable. And I'm a musician. Well, actually, first, I'm a husband and a father and 4 children. I'm a composer, musician, instrumentalist, visual artist, and now filmmaker. So I've been doing this for quite a while, full time. And most of our art is not, it deals with stuff and sounds that are popular, maybe more modern. It also pulls from the past as well. Like in some of our stories, like the one we're going to address today, Queen of the Night is a period piece, and some of it's vaudevillian and older classical style. But a lot of our stuff is very modern, but it does not participate in the pop pattern. We're trying to tell bigger stories, a lot of mythology, a lot of fairy tale perspective in our music, but the stories are often darker and more dystopian, as a reflection and a warning of the world we live in right now and what that environment can do to our soul if we're not paying attention. So generally, all of our projects revolve around a story arc. And some of the stories are tragic, where we see where the main character takes a dark path and the wrong path. And some stories are, of that more comedic pattern, not in the sense that they're funny, but in the sense that, the characters all ends well or ends better for our heroes in our story. So we've been doing that for a while. We call our music there's a variety of styles we work through. Although I think our songwriting styles are consistent across these styles, like that you can always tell it's us. I don't even know how to say it. It's hard to describe. Like, I mean, it's like trying to describe someone a perfume smell in a perfume ad. You have to pick it up and listen to it. But again, we're trying to get to the sense that there's a bigger story going on, that something cinematic is happening in the music. So there's a lot of emotion. We use a word in our own circles called muchy, meaning that if something's going to break your heart, we really want it to break your heart. If something's going to be aggressive, it's going to be very aggressive. So we don't just dip our toes into whatever the subject matter is or the direction we're heading. We try to go there and saturate it as much as we can. So, and that's what we're doing right now. We released Queen of the Night. I'm working on another film slated for 2024. It's a werewolf film, which should be fun. It's kind of a dark fairy tale, not necessarily a horror version of a werewolf story. And working on a Christmas project that will be released in segments over the next 3 Christmases with an author. I will not mention the people's names yet. And an iconographer who's doing the artwork. So we're doing that. And then right now I'm actually recording another sort of apocalyptic story that's supposed to be released later this spring.
Wow. Awesome. That's a lot. It's a lot of stuff.
Yeah, a little busy.
That sounds great. And then the reason I said I questioned whether you're the lead singer, because it's you and your wife, right?
Yeah. I should have mentioned my wife. My goodness. Yeah, she is. When we met, we were cast in a musical. She was on the West Coast in Los Angeles where she auditioned, and I auditioned in Providence, Rhode Island. And that's where we met. We were two leads in a musical. And we were cast because they thought there'd be some chemistry and that we would go well together. And apparently a casting director was 100% right in our opinion. So ever since that moment, Kate was already a singer-songwriter. And I was like more in a rock and kind of a funk world in the 90s. And we kind of like put our peanut butter and chocolate together and made Dirt Poor Robins. And I think the subject matters we cover and the subject matter we cover and the approaches we take and the sound of our music has a lot to do with what our relationship is like. We talk about everything. We have, I think there's a lot of depth to our conversation and our relationship, and hopefully that comes out in our music. And of course the love that binds us together. We do more duets than the normal cinematic rock band or indie band would do. So we end up doing duets. I would not say I'm the lead singer, because I would say she probably carries the brunt of the work. She's the better singer of the two of us. I think as far as the range of type of songs she can sing, like I can put virtually any type of song in front of her and she can do it within her own style and nail it. And for me, I know when I write a song, if I can sing it or I'm going to have to give it to her. If it's one that just, I feel like the content might have a little more power coming from a man or a masculine perspective, or it might provide a better juxtaposition, I will sing it if I can. So it's probably a 70-30 split we have on the vocals.
Gotcha. Well, I think that some of the best songs are when you guys are singing together. I think those are... not that, you know, by yourselves or it's like deficient or anything, but it's like together you guys are make a really cool, there's a really cool sound that you guys produce, when you're singing together. Yeah. It's really cool. Now I'm not a music person. As I said, kind of in the beginning, I used to be more, but you know, I just kind of, there's just not a whole lot out there popular wise, you know, that is worth listening to in my opinion. And that's obviously a very subjective opinion. So that's kind of why, but I used to be in band, you know, in choir.
In ads and in film, and it's happening all the time. And sometimes we're not even aware of it when, you know, you're on an elevator or at a mall or shopping or, you know, if you go to a church, you're probably going to experience some music. So music's a part of everything now. The problem when people talk about new music is that, the new music now is being created for more of a TikTok culture, more of a short attention span audience. Right. We all know the reasons, I think, that they contribute to our growing or shrinking attention span, I should say. So what happens in pop music a lot of times, people who are thinkers and people who might be in something like philosophy or spirituality, or some of the deeper patterns in religion, are not going to find a lot to sink their teeth into because the audiences don't have the attention span. It's not entirely the artist's fault that are singing about these licentious things, maybe. Sure. But they're doing whatever they can to get someone's attention and to be relatable.
Right.
And so because the audience can't stick with you for more than 5 to 8 seconds at a time and hold in their memory what happened prior to that, people are forced to constantly string together images like that in repetitive hooks. And if you're not... if you're not a certain type of person, you're not going to find that like a satisfying meal. You're going to find that like, you know, candy, and it's going to rot your teeth and rot your soul. And I don't think it's really good for anyone at the end of the day. At the same time, I'm sympathetic to why it exists and why you might not be interested in a lot of music. I have the same problem. It's maybe once or twice a year I come across something new where I'm really like, wow, like I'm glad this exists. But most of the time it's just like, yeah, I can put that in the bin with the same old that's been happening and getting worse for the last 10 years.
Right. Yeah. And I used to be the kind of person who would be like, yeah, there's nothing good that's being done now in the arts at all. Obviously not. That's kind of why I started this podcast, because I discovered that there are Catholic authors, you know, Orthodox writers, Protestant, whatever, that are producing good quality, you know, either nonfiction or pieces of fiction or music or whatever. And that's why I started the show, because I was kind of sick of the negativity in some conservative Christian circles of like, you know, only the classics are good, you know, and there's nothing new that's good. And, you know, so I'm like, that's not really true.
Yeah. Well, new things can't totally compete with the classics because there's a canonization process that happens.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But, you know, things that get the most attention and that seem to transcend just the fads going on are the things we remember. So if you look back at 1985, you're like, oh my gosh, like there were so many great songs in 1985. And then, but you're forgetting literally conveniently forgotten all of the terrible songs and all the terrible songs and the terrible recordings. And so that's the same with literature. We look back into the past and we see all these wonderful classics. And I think those things are still popping up here and there now. It's just that we don't have the benefit of what time does to that, where it condenses it like a fine wine. So we can look back at an era and really just be able to peruse the best of that era. But now living in the moment of our own era, we have to sort through all the manure.
Right. Yep.
In the meanwhile.
Yep. And I think that's probably true of every age, like kind of what you're saying. But yeah, so that's why I started this. And then you guys are Orthodox Christians, right?
Yeah.
Eastern Orthodox.
Yep, exactly. So that's probably about, it's been maybe a decade long journey, but for the last 4 years, we would have called ourselves that. So
cool. Yeah.
And our chrismation, which is like when you're actually, you know, like what Catholics call confirmation, we did that in 2021. Or 2020. I'm not sure. I don't remember now. I thought it was 2020.
Maybe. Who remembers these things? Then?
I can remember these things. Cool. Those two years were a blur there. An absolute blur. So.
Yeah. Well, that's awesome. And so have you guys been... So if you kind of came into the Orthodox Church a couple of years ago, you've obviously been making music a lot longer than that. Were you guys always kind of Christian? Because I can kind of see that going back into like your album Leviathan and like... which is, what, 2009? Obviously, there's a lot of biblical themes in that album. Were you guys always Christian or no?
Well, no, not always Christians. Sure. I mean, when we're doing music, yes, in some form or another. So it's one of these tricky subjects to talk about because you never like. So you and I think you have an understanding of what Orthodoxy is probably. Mm-hmm. But the general audience doesn't necessarily. So when they hear the phrase Christian or they hear a phrase like that. What comes to mind is, potentially a number of things that don't represent us at all. like right. Televangelism, evangelism, that type of proselytization. They might think of a certain type of art, modern art, Christian worship, and things like that. Really don't have anything to do with our life right now. And at the same time, we've never considered ourselves a Christian band.
Yeah.
That's never been in Durpo Robin's career. That's never been our goal. At the same time, we have a way of looking at the world, and I'm very familiar. I'm familiar with a lot of older mythology, a lot of lore and stories like that. But also, I think my better area of expertise would be the Bible itself. Mm-hmm. And I think the Bible itself in the world right now, because it's unarguably the most influential book. Is that language will permeate our music because it permeates the culture, and it actually is understandable to some degree. Now, again, when you're talking about Christianity, I think that people they don't know what's in the Bible a lot of times, and they don't understand the level of sophistication. You talk to them about these kind of things, they're more concerned sometimes if, well, did Christ actually exist? Like, where's his birth certificate? I don't even ever have to think about it that way because I'm familiar with the text. I'm familiar with what he said. Right. And, what he says is undeniable when you understand it. Like there's no way you can be saturated in these stories, these parables, what's happening in the Bible, the way it's all hyperlinked together into this majestic tapestry. You can't, it's going to be hard to explain that to an outsider. It's going to be hard for them to see it. In fact, there's a lot of Christians that have no idea what any of what I'm talking about is either. They're part of the culture. They go to church, but they don't know it. So, it's the, it's been an infinite resource for creativity for me, because it, you know, I think I'm pretty keen sometimes, but it seems to see the world more accurately and in a much deeper way than I do. So it's always nice to have a source that you can go to when you have an intuition and you see that your intuition's already in the source. It gives you a little extra strength and a little extra depth to push those ideas forward. So yeah, there's it's definitely a part of it. Now, some of the projects we have coming up are going to be a little more, a little deeper into some of those stories. So our next album is our first dive into hagiography, and for people who aren't into that category, it's you know, like the stories of the saints. These are martyrs and confessors, people who were persecuted for their faith. And so there's a very interesting saint. It's a very strange one. Is Saint Praphorios the Mime, or the Mimic. And it's this wonderful story about this, you know, in the Roman Empire, when it was pagan, where the court jester would mock Christianity for the delight of the magistrates. And in Praphorius' story, he mocked the baptism, an actual Christian baptism, and says the words and goes through the ceremony. And then he sees the light and sees angels and has a conversion experience. Yeah. And it's this bizarre story. It's just like in this place where Christianity is like dead, how it just sparks to life in a moment of mockery. So I really wanted to explore the pattern of a joke and a flip like that. So that, you know, and that, and then, so also because we do concept records, we're doing a Christmas record, and it's going to be about the nativity story.
Okay.
Because people been bugging us for years to do Christmas stuff. And in a marketing sense, I was always like, yeah, that'd be a good idea, because like every Christmas our views and listens go down because everybody's listening to Christmas music.
Right.
And we don't have any. Right. But no, in that sense, but that's never been enough to make me do it. But there was, I finally like came up with the approach I wanted to take that felt Dirk Poor Robinsy take on the story. And there's this wonderful little short creed in 1 Timothy 3:16, where it testifies to a bunch of, like in five lines, to what Christ did. And in the middle of the third line, it says he was seen by angels. And so we wanted to tell the nativity story top down from an angelic perspective, looking down at the earth, as opposed to this sort of like general normal telling of Mary, you know, and what's it like to be her? What was it like to be pregnant, traveling on a donkey?
Mary, did you know?
Yeah, that guy. That's what I call a horizontal read on a story. We're going to take a more vertical take, like where it's connecting the heavens and the earth, and there's this cosmic pattern in the story. So we're going to deal with more, I mean, in a category I don't use the phrase for much, but more of a metaphysical telling of that story. Okay. So we're going to work on that and release it over the next 3 years. So these two next stories are, you know, I write about whatever comes to me and whatever dawns on me. And so our next two stories, the Christmas one will definitely seem like a Christian record. I don't know if, not that a record can be Christian, not, you know, I mean, there's ideas and stuff that's Christian, but it's not like it's going to be, it's not. So in the Protestant world, what people are used to with Christian stuff is that, like, you know, you think of a Kirk Cameron movie and how it has an agenda for the audience. It has a perspective it's trying to put on the audience, as opposed to telling a story and letting it, you know, play out the way it would or way it should, or or way to impart wisdom. You know, and so we see that same pattern of storytelling is kind of destroying Hollywood, is that there's a political view that is being rammed down our throats in those stories, and they're trying to force a perspective on the audience. And these things kind of end up feeling a little hollow, like a PSA. Now, to the people within those circles, they don't, because they're so on board with the messaging that they might even get goosebumps and chills just to hear their own quotes confirmed through a speaker, you know, musically. But we don't operate like that. So we're telling the stories in a way that we find like is going to be compelling and draw an audience in, and but be truthful at the end of the day, but not truthful in the sense we're trying to give you a proper set of definitions to walk away from. Truthful in the sense that it's hopefully going to inspire more of that childlike awe and wonder you used to have that slowly gets stamped out of you by the modern world. Hopefully it'll open a window into a greater reality, as opposed to reducing it into like, oh, now you're part of my ideology.
Right. No, it makes sense. Yeah, it's good stuff. I know there's a lot of like really bad Christian art, and I think it's getting better. I think there are more Christian, like I think Catholic and Orthodox, I mean, people like C.S. Lewis, like so High Church Anglicans, they do a better job, I think, more often than not, because of how incarnational our faith is. And you see Christ in the physical world, so to speak, you know? And so you can tell stories that embody those patterns. Whereas a Protestant, you know, I'm not digging on all Protestants, you know, but usually American evangelical types, it's going to be more, I don't want to say straightforward, but it's going to be like more propagandistic, you know?
Yeah, like they don't mean it that way. You know what I mean?
So, it's sincerely hard, felt.
It's a hard thing for an artist because like, you know, so even if their goal is like something like, gee, we would like, you know, I want to take you to church on this record or something like
right,
that.
Right. Yeah.
Goal is, I want to soothe some of this pain and loneliness you have in your soul. There might be really good reasons why, or they feel like they've got an incredible treasure they found and they want to share that treasure.
Right.
The hard thing to do is that a lot of evangelical Christians are categorically conservative and temperamentally conservative. And so I'm not talking about conservative politics at all. Right. I'm talking just about a way of seeing the world is where, they're not this is why Hollywood is filled with liberals, because they're more open.
Yep.
Right. They're more open to ideas. They're more open to exploring things. And this has positive and negative aspects to it. Right. So you can. So the problem for a lot of evangelical Christianity is that it does skew, and it does appeal to people who are naturally conservative, who kind of have like a burn it with fire response to new things. So even in all their attempts to try to share something they think is good, they try to, again, force a message into it. So there's something I say about storytelling that's really important, and you really get this in the a lot of the European fairy tales and older stories, mm-hmm. is that there's a wildness, there's a feralness to the story, in the sense that like you understand there's like some kind of coherent language happening in the story, but you can't really pin it all down and you can't say exactly what the story is trying to get across. But somehow it feels like it's tapping into, it's like, you know, scratching the surface or starting to dig into a deeper truth. So I just have a short story. I used to tell that by how my creative process works, because I don't want to make propaganda. I want it to have a life of its own when I release it. So you treat an idea like a wild animal, like that it was injured. And so now I'm a conservationist. I have to nurse this animal back to health. But mm-hmm. because this animal's endangered, because there isn't enough of this animal in the world, I have to raise it back to health in a way that it can go back out and it won't be domesticated, that it can have a life again right. in the wild. And so that means that you have to be okay with the idea that people are going to miss it, like a parable, like that it's going to go right over some people's head, the thing that you hope they would see.
Right.
And that's fine, because otherwise there's nothing to dig for, nothing to discover, and no joy in the discovery. So the what an artist is trying to do by intuition is something like, oh, I don't know, someone who makes an Easter egg hunt for kids. Like you know the age of the kids, and you have a sense that like, well, we want them to find all the eggs, but we don't want them to just be sitting on top of the grass like we would hide from 3-year-olds. These are 8-year-old kids, and they're going to be a little bit better at finding
right.
eggs. So we've got to make this a rewarding challenge and put them in spots where they could find them, but it's going to take some work. And so, you know, an artist who's not participating in propaganda is going to do that by intuition. They're going to lay their story out in such a way that it has a wildlife and it can, you know, it is pointing in a direction, but it can mean different things, or there can be different takeaways. And there is going to be stuff that people are never going to understand, but hopefully there's some kind of symbolic thread or through line that you can tell that this wheel, even though you can't see the axle of the wheel, you can tell it's all turning around a coherent axle.
Right. Yeah. I think that's it's so important to, yeah, not just give away the answers, you know.
Yeah, it's boring. I mean,
it's boring. Yeah, it's boring. I mean, there's so many authors that I've come to love. It kind of, they embrace not ambiguity in terms of like morality, but ambiguity in terms of like this. What does the story mean? You know, like what are they saying here? And if you could piece it together yourself and come up with, oh yeah, that's clearly they mean this. This is what this author is doing. Like, it took me for, there's an author I really like. His name is, this is my obligatory Tim Powers reference. Every episode I have to mention Tim Powers, or else he'll come to my house and hit me over the head or something. But he does this all the time, and it took me forever to figure out how to read his books because I enjoyed them, and they read like fairy tales. So there's a wildness to them. There's this like sort of craziness about them. And I'm like, what is he doing? Like, I enjoy these books, but what is he doing? And it took me forever, but I finally figured out, like, through another essay. There's very few essays on Tim Powers out there, literary criticism. But he said that what Tim Powers is doing is writing upside down fairy tales, you know, or he's taking, or he's writing, he has the villains doing something that's heterodox in terms of, you know, Orthodox Christian, small o Orthodox Christian belief. And he's taking that and he's kind of twisting it. And if you look at like what the heroes are doing, that is like they're kind of embodying the Orthodox view of it, you know, or something to that effect. Or this event that the villains are doing in his novel is occurring on this feast day, and what they're doing is an inverse of what's going on at feast day, right? So that's what he's doing in a lot of his books. And as soon as I realized that, I'm like, my mind exploded. You know, I'm like, wow, that's amazing. This is so cool. But it took me years to figure that out. And it was so rewarding when it did, when I was able to get there, you know?
Yeah, it's so nice when an author has their thing too, or a writer or a director, they have their thing. And because, you know, a lot of times your way of telling a story can be, it can be very narrow, but because of the multiplicity of scenarios that are available for it can be really incredible. And you know, not everybody loves Wes Anderson, but I kind of like Wes Anderson films quite a bit. My wife likes them too. And so if you just look at Wes Anderson, for example, and the way he tells stories is that you enter the story and every character is process driven. They have a very specific tradition, like, or a process they're upholding. Mm-hmm. And we get to know the characters through their lens of process. And even the director's approach, he doubles down on this idea by framing things up so symmetrically all the time. You know, a lot of right angles, a lot of, you know, panning shots that stay on a horizontal plane. And so there's something very linear about his visual to match this idea with the story. But then every one of his stories, the character is... there's an anomaly that their own process doesn't account for. And the story is about the journey to adapting to that anomaly and updating your process so it accounts for the anomaly as well. And so every one of Wes Anderson films can kind of be brought into that. If that's the hero, the character arc.
Yeah.
But because, you know, because we have lots of filmmakers and whatever, we have a certain flavor we go to Wes Anderson for, and that's his flavor. And there's a quirkiness to it. And there's a handmade quality to his films. But at the same time, like, that's just how he tells stories. And you know what? I think for the rest of his life, he can probably plug different scenarios into that idea and keep doing it and keep me entertained. So that's one of the other things you're trying to find as an artist is you're like, yeah, what's my, what am I good at, or where does an audience's eyes light up? Or even what gives me a lump in my throat? Like, what moves me internally? And you might find that, like, you have a thing, like, and then to stick with that thing and chase that thing is better than trying to, like you see on American Idol, like, sometimes there'll be this great singer. I didn't watch the show that much, but I remember this happening to someone. I think she was a country singer, and she wanted to show people that she could rock one week, and she just was terrible at it. It was terrible at it. And it was like, and all the judges were like, why didn't you just do your thing? And they're like, well, people were saying that I was just a country singer. And they're like, yeah, that's fine. Like, just be a country singer.
Right.
It's like, you don't have to be everything to all people. You have to have your thing that is palatable to some. So, and attractive to some. So that's what's so neat about what you're saying though. Like the fact that, like, oh my gosh, like, I was given this key to sort of interpret what a certain writer is doing, and now it gives me a deeper appreciation, and I actually can now take that and pull more out of the stories. I think that's super cool when there's something coherent that emerges.
Another author like Gene Wolfe does something similar. He nests stories inside other stories that kind of reflect what's going on in the wider narrative. That's how you can use those stories as a key to kind of deciphering what the wider story is doing. So a lot of it's subtext. And so that's a key to understanding his stories is those mini stories that are embedded within his wider story. So authors who do that, they can add a layer to, and any writer can do that and add a layer of meaning to their, what they're doing. And I think it just adds depth even if they're not like the most amazing writer in the world. You know, it's like, I'm not saying Tim Powers is the most amazing writer in the world, but there's definitely a depth that other writers don't have, right? So let's go. So you in 2019, you guys released a concept album called Dead Horse.
Yes.
And that's how I first got introduced to Dirt Poor Robins. And this, like, man, it was so cool. So you guys, you released this concept album, and it's got this kind of Lovecraftian, like H.P. Lovecraft atmosphere. You have this the concept of, like, yeah, awakening old gods, you know, through, I think, drilling in Alaska or something like that. And and the major themes are, like, you know, tampering with angels, you know, which are demons, you know, and in this case, to better human, for bettering humanity. And you use a lot of this, the thing I really liked about watching the video, you know, like the actual video portion of the
whole album together with the lyrics.
Yeah. And the visual, well, the visual stuff is you pair like old science fiction movies with with your songs. Super cool. Like, my favorite probably is It Tore Your Heart Out with the old Superman, you know.
Yeah, all those Fleischer cartoons are public domain now. It's pretty crazy.
Yeah, wow, that's cool. Yeah. Yeah, so, like, tell just briefly, like, go through what, why did you write this album, and what were you trying to do?
okay yeah, so, you know, I think that most of the story ideas come to me, and I don't even know why at first. Like, the story ideas and its points will come to me before I know why they did. Mm-hmm. And so I think a lot of times, like, you know, there's a problem in the world and you're pondering it and you're considering it, and you're hopefully, as an artist, you're good at pattern recognition, and that you're not just good at pattern recognition, you're good at seeing where the pattern's leading. So you imagine, if this pattern remains in effect unchecked, this is where we will head. This is where it will go.
Right.
So the name for the record started out because I became aware of this town, Dead Horse, Alaska, when I was a kid. I was watching a television show, and they had a contest to see who lived in the worst city in America, and someone, Dead Horse, Alaska, won. Wow. And Dead Horse, Alaska is, you know, right at the very top of the world there. It's one of the northernmost places in America. The thing is, because it's a they're collecting oil in Prudhoe Bay from Dead Horse, mm-hmm. that the town is almost entirely male. I think it was like a 70-1 male to female ratio. And oof. So, and there was like no trees up there. So the town slogan, the town flag, was a picture of a horse with his eyes X'd out.
Oh, gosh.
And the town slogan was, there's a girl behind every tree. So I was like, it really stuck with me. And then, then another thing happened. I think it was around 2017. We had booked an Airbnb on the west coast of Florida for a little family vacation, and a humble little beach town. And they had such a bad red tide that no one could go into the town. Like, people were having to flee because of the dead fish and whatever. I was like, oh, this is terrible timing. Let me see if I can get out of this. And the owner was particularly stingy, which is fine. But he was like, nope. And so I checked with Airbnb's policies, and I was looking through their cancellation policies. And one of the policies was for a pandemic, you could get a refund. And I was like, does this qualify as a pandemic? So I started looking up pandemics, and I was like, oh my gosh, like, we have a massive problem here. I said that, just in the back of my head, I was like, oh, like, this. So there was something about our culture that was becoming so safety driven. It was like a safety first culture, right?
Yeah.
Which is, you know, I like Mike Rowe, he says safety third, which right. I think is, because you have to, I don't know, like, you know, it was safer to not go on a seesaw, right, as a kid, but it's more fun to go on a seesaw than to not, like, to right. just sit there on one. So, you know, things remaining in balance and safe all the time is not where we learn, is definitely not a learning space, or growing space. So that it didn't make sense. But I really was like, oh my gosh, like, just the smallest thing, like, just a worse than normal flu could start causing lockdowns and, like, pandemic reactions and panic. And it just a story idea popped into my head. So one of the things we do is we mythologize things in our story. We look at patterns in the world, and instead of describing those patterns, instead of talking about oil or electricity, so in the story of Dead Horse, there's this underwater panther. I don't use it by name, but it's an old Native American myth.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and the underwater panther. And then there's the Thunderbird. And yep. So I have these two opposing, like one's like a god of electricity in a way, and the other one's the god of oil. And but I never say that in the story, and I don't say it anywhere on the record, but I kind of give a lot of hints. So, you know, so we mythologize these patterns because if you pay attention, like, they do function they do function like small g gods did, right, in a mythological panthos, like in the way they function in our culture and the way they're attended to and the way we sacrifice to it and the way we sacrifice for it. And the, you know, when they grow in power, what that means for those industries. If you think about it, there's a lot of like direct analogies to it. So the story kind of unfolded out of that. We came up with a story where we projected into the future where there was this world that was being shut down by a sequences of pandemics that were being used to take control, and that AI was going to be the solution for the loneliness and the disconnectedness of people.
Right.
So the AI, like, they came up with this program in the story called the Saints, which is an acronym,
right?
S-A-I-N-T-S. And the Saints were supposed to be like our guides. Like, they were better than us and they were going to show us how to be happy. But in the end, they just ended up being some sort of like, the plan was to make them just this moral therapeutic AI where its goal in the story is to make us feel wonderful about everything we do and think and are already. So as if we've already arrived, and even to the point of the story where like you're constantly accompanied by your own film score that is taking these mundane tasks and these unnecessary tasks and making them feel like they're of great importance.
Right.
So that was part of the manipulation of the story. So the neat thing was we started releasing this in, you know, chapters like we do a lot, and it was 2019. And I mean, neat thing, I mean, kind of like tragically neat. And then by 2020, we had the perfect album for the pandemic.
Yeah, I know.
if you look at songs like But Never a Key or It Tore Right. Your Heart Out, and some of these songs, and even like election controversies over, you have the both perspectives in the mm-hmm. song The Same Too. You had the both perspectives of what was going on during the 2020 elections.
Right.
Like, was this fraudulent? Is that, no, the system's fine. And like this literal, there's this duet with a dialogue that goes back and forth. And a lot of it just kind of hit the nail on the head.
Yep.
so that's what happened with Dead Horse. So it's interesting. I mean, I'm very leery of AI. I think that, hopefully our music's helpful for this culture, because I think our culture is decided, and they've been pushed to decide this, and it's convenient as a consumer to tell people to decide this, that your desires that set you apart from other people, your idiosyncrasies, these are your identity.
Right.
And I think that the classic version of identity is that which transcends your desires, right?
Right.
And that way your identity, you can hold something higher, and then you can take your desires and you can hold them with some scrutiny or some skepticism, because you don't know why. You don't always know why you want what you want. And so I think these themes and these stories are helpful, end up being helpful now, because, you know, where it gives people the language, hopefully, to maybe look around and be like, oh, wait a minute, maybe we built a world we weren't made for. Maybe there's things in this world and there's some kind of pattern to it that's really screwing us up. Just like it did when they first put animals in zoos and they're like, let's put them in these concrete boxes with
right.
bars so people can see them, and they're like, gee, these animals, they're not behaving very well, they're not eating properly, they're aggressive,
yeah, the or birds are pulling out their own feathers and the tigers are chewing off their own fur. Yeah, what's going on here? Yeah,
you can't get them to mate, what is going on? And then somebody comes along, it's like, let's make it look like a jungle, and they're like, hey, look, they're normal now. But they're not normal, because you still have to keep them in there. You have to put up walls or they will escape.
Right.
Why will they escape if they have everything they need? Because all of us need something more than just having what we need. We need the challenge. We need the struggle. All of that's meaningful in life. So our stories deal with these themes over and over again. So I think that can be really helpful for the contemplation of some people growing up in a world where they're just kind of told that, like, no, their desires are part of their genetic makeup. And it's like, no, man, like, it's both things. There is a part of, like, you know, your body where it's going to have certain desires and certain things, but there are also things that can screw with that. And it's not depersoning to have those conversations. So, you know, that's like a story like Dead Horse. I think it did a couple of things. Hopefully for some people, it helped them put the right kind of tinfoil hat on for the pandemic, so that they weren't going to give up their humanity to follow, the narrative, you know, because we still have to be human beings. We still need other contact. We need community. We need these things, or we will become very depressed and all kinds of bad things will happen. Not to mention that in a bigger way, all of our stories, we think that these small things we're experiencing are are a way to understand the cosmos itself, like a bigger story at work. That that with when we like when I talk about community and relationships, those things are microcosms for a bigger story that's happening. Those things are mediating an unseen truth to us. So you know, I think that these things are. These things are vital to humanity, and our culture doesn't seem to have a pulse on this anymore. We're just very disconnected from each other and from our reality and from nature.
Yeah. So, well, we go from thing to thing to thing without even thinking about it. You know, we just, we just consume and, you know, whatever the media or whatever tells us what the next thing to be upset about is, then we're upset about that. Right. So it's, we're very much dominated by, like our impulses are dominated by this, I don't know, push button culture we have of, you know, consuming the news, Twitter, whatever, you know, and just getting our passions riled up by the next thing. And having been grounded in sort of this symbolic, these symbolic patterns in Christianity, it can be very freeing from, you know, so we don't have, we used to worry about stuff, but it's not, we're not at the whim of the people who generate the narratives, you know, whether intentionally or not. I mean, I don't know. It's people, there's groupthink, right? So people all just kind of think the same thing at once, and there's not really a conspiracy. It's just people, you know, people thinking all that way at the same time. Now, there are conspiracies too, but like it's not so cut and dry.
Yeah, kind of a mass psychosis.
Yeah, yeah. I think there's definitely both going on.
We don't understand how vulnerable we are. Like, right. It's one of the things I say, too, is like we kind of deal with this in Dead Horse and Queen of the Night, is you don't bring – nothing comes into your life for free, meaning right. that every – you have to – it's a good idea to think about everything you pick up and add to yourself that it changes you, and it will change your perspective. You know, and there's lots of great versions of this. Having kids will change your perspective, but also at the same time, you'll see spaces differently once you bring a kid into it. You'll go into a house, you look at your own house, and you're like, oh my gosh, look at all these fragile, breakable glass things we have at kid reachable
level.
The
death trap.
So, like, you'd be like, yeah, I'm the same person, but it's like, no, you're not. Now you're looking at the world through your kid's eyes too.
Right.
And so houses, cars, jobs, music, all of this stuff, like, you know, if we're not tending our internal garden properly, our soul,
right.
we're going to go into this world and we're going to chase after thing. And we're going to chase after fixes and we're going to use the world like a drug relationship. We're going to have these relationships with our pushers that sell us the entertainment and sell us the things that give us our little fix.
Yep.
And we're never going to realize we're using that to replace what can only be found in real relationships.
Right.
So,
yeah. Well, I tell you, having a real relationship and a real spouse is really nice when you're sick. That's why every time I'm sick, my wife's like, yeah, it's just one more big kid to take care of, you know?
Oh, my gosh, I'm so bad at being sick.
Well, my wife is sick. It's like the world falls apart. You know, I'm like, okay, I got to take care of the kids. I got to take care of her. I got to cook dinner. And it's all me, you know, it's for her. She's like a rock star. She just, you know, that's just what she does every day. And for me, I'm like, oh, we're going to die. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, my wife, Kate, wasn't naturally domestic and she's still way better at those type of things than me in understanding them. I'm like, do our kids need food?
Right.
Like,
yeah.
How much water do they drink?
Right. Like, what's wrong with the big one? What's his name? Christopher? What's wrong with him again? Yeah. Oh man. Yeah. So that was, yeah. Having those real relationships. Like I've been saying for a while, the kids, having kids, cause I'm coming on four kids myself. It like makes you crazy, but it also like is what keeps you sane. I think it actually makes you like more sane because you have to like focus on them, you know, as opposed to like more abstract concepts like politics and whatever. But like, you feel like you're going crazy, but actually you are more sane than people who are, you know, really heavily involved in politics and the culture and stuff like that. You're more sane than they are, even though it doesn't seem like it.
Yeah, no, you nailed it right there. It's hard for people to see. And this is, again, like part of what we're doing in like our style of storytelling is that, you know, so I have a presupposition that everything we see is ordained to be one way and not another, that there's an ordinance to the universe. And that in fact, like, I don't even see through a scientific lens how people can believe otherwise, because obviously, like, you know, gravity must always be answered if you're going to stand up. You must provide an equal and opposite force, that there is a way that is the universe is ordered. If you want to do a certain thing, there's a certain way to do it. But not just that, is that a very non-nihilistic view is that I think it was all made for a reason. I think it was all made intelligibly. Mm-hmm. And I think it, all the seen world is made in such a way where it, it shows us, if we have the right eyes, it can show us the unseen world. And like, so like, it's like the invisible number in an algebraic equation. It, I hate to use a, you know, mathematical example, but it's like a really good way to say it. It's like, okay, you can see that, like, you know, these tracks were heading in this direction, and you can tell by the shape of the track that this is probably a bear that way, and you don't want to go that way. Like, you know, you, right. you know, you can see the unseen bear before you have to run into it. And the world's legible that way. And so I think that it's, I think it's super sad that, I don't think that there's any reason why people can't look at the universe both ways, meaning that there was a process that led to the point where we're here as conscious beings, on an earthly sense, on a material sense, that you know, there's a bottom-up process. But also at the same time, like, just because there's a bottom-up process doesn't mean that now the top-down process doesn't exist. That, like, but all of this is here because it was created for meaning. It was created out of love. Right. It was created to tell a story. It was created for a story for you to experience and interact with. It was created as a test. So these things, like, I don't see any contradiction between those things. I think it's a very radical position to not be able to look at it from top down, because in a practical scientific sense, like, there's, you cannot bring something into existence without it having a purpose. It's an impossible experiment. And so there's yeah. zero examples of anything ever generating itself. Right. And that anything existing without a purpose, because even if I give you the small project of being like, hey, you know what, Aaron, make me an object that has no purpose. You're like, got it, on it. And you go and do it. Guess what? It had a quest to begin with. It has a purpose. Like, right. No, yeah. That purpose might not be obvious to someone else. They might not know that conversation we had when they look at it. They'd be like, this thing has no purpose. And but they'd be wrong.
Its purpose is to have no purpose.
And so when you get into, you know, I think people made the mistake of arguing for the like, trying to prove God exists somehow. And it's yeah. like, it's just absolutely necessary. Like, God's existence is absolutely, if you dare to look at anything that exists and subsist, you keep asking questions, you're going to hit a point where there has to be an infinite source yeah. for all these things, right? And so for me, like, that's the type of storytelling I'm in. I think that we went through a hiccup in our culture where really this sort of detached nihilism and atheism abounded for, you know, a few generations. Yeah. I see it starting to unravel now. I think that it's disappointing. It's unsatisfying.
Yeah.
And it's depressing. And it's cruel. Like, not only that, like, to sit there and tell people that the proper logical perspective is that they're a clump of cells that exist randomly, and that their consciousness, their fact that they know they exist, this is just was a random process that happened to work out so right. that they're here today. And, you know, and it's like, man, if you just don't have friends, or you're just not a popular kid, or you can't thrive in this system, this, you know, kind of, if you're not going to rise to the top of capitalism or popularity, like, you've offered that person nothing.
Right.
Offered nothing. And in fact, I think what you said is a lie, and you can't prove it. So,
but like, don't worry, it's all meaningless anyway. So even if you roast the top, it wouldn't matter.
Right. Like, so what kind of person tells their friends these kind of things? What right. kind of person, like, even some of the narratives about, like, you know, race and stuff like that, like, these mm-hmm. things can be really touchy subjects, but just think about it this way. Imagine if you came home and you're like, oh, these people were so nice to me. They, you know, they were like, whatever. And someone's like, listen, they don't really like you. They're using yeah. you. They're this, like, that was the interpretation for everything.
Yeah.
Right. In certain really dynamics, cynical. Like, you don't want that friend. Like, that person is not your friend. So,
right.
I think that, you know, I think that it's funny we're talking about all this because of Dead Horse, but these are the things I was really, like, yeah. at the time the story birthed in me, I realized that there was, like, this thing that was, like, there was this kind of neo-atheism, like, the new atheism that was going to die, but it was going to, a lot of people were going to suffer in the meanwhile. And not only that, we were suffering in the meanwhile, we were clinging so hard to our comfort in this life, because under this nihilistic interpretation of the world and materialist interpretation of the world, that's all you've got. That's like, right. You're losing if you're not comfortable, if you're not happy, if you're not satiated, you're losing. If you're not on top, you're losing. And I mean, that is a stupid, stupid way to think of the world, because no one wins in that game.
Right.
No one wins. No one can maintain that position forever. No one can be the top dog and have the most money and the most things or enough things. Because eventually your life's going to fade. And so this is why people are clinging so hard to their safety and not the opportunity they have with their life.
Right. Wow. Yeah, that's Dead Horse. that album, there's a lot going on in that album. I think we should probably switch gears to talking about Queen of the Night. If that's cool with you, because that, I think I've watched that. I watched your director's commentary a couple nights ago, right before I got really sick, which was good.
It was too much information.
Yeah. Well, then I spent the next couple of days in a fever dream with Dirt Poor Robin songs playing in my head. You know, I'm like, oh man, it's probably overloaded on your music. Why don't you tell us about Queen of the Night? There's a lot going on with this, and this is probably your first full comprehensive story, I want to say, you know, where instead of like, I think Dead Horse had a story too, but it was more along a concept than, I mean, there are characters and stuff in it, but
So I mean, I just didn't, so with those previous stories, I when you're reading Tolkien and he's fully realized this world, and you just get little glimpses into it. You get like little peepholes into the past through songs, and like his hymnography includes and little stories about, you know, the elves of old and stuff. So, but he's actually gone through the process of thinking that through. That's why we do concept records, because we think through the idea, and then the songs are generally not exposition, but like a reflection on that moment in the story.
Happens. Right.
But now this isn't, but you could just pick up one of our songs and listen to it outside of a weird word here and there. It might just seem like, oh, this is just a song about a thing. So what happened with Queen of the Night is when the story came to me, the prologue, the very first scene with the little boy and the moon girl, that whole scene kind of came to me in one flash. And I woke up with that and I was like, oh, okay. So I chased it down. I'm like, okay, so the story's going to go into him being older. I already know how it's going to end. And then I kind of, you know, finished the rest of the details. I'm like, oh, okay, this story feels really coherent. It's really interesting to me. It's got a lot of visual anchors. Unlike some of our other stories that, you know, deal just straight up with concepts, there's this idea of like the role glasses play in the film, looking through lenses, the role of a rocket ship, a city, the ontology of how a city goes from, you know, above to below and, you know, forms up like this pyramid shape, and all these things were so, there were so many visual elements that were so key to the story. I was like, man, are we going to have to make a graphic novel for this one? What are we going to do? And I was like, oh, wait a minute. Like, so I've had some experience in film. And so I was, I knew that like, okay, like when I wrote it as a screenplay. And when I looked at it, I was like, this is way too expensive and no one's going to let me make this film. Like no one, like who's going to give me the $50 million I need to make this film as an unproven director? And it just hit me. It was like, oh, okay. Cause one of the things we don't want to do is we don't want to make something like halfway there, like, you know, or just a little bit and let the audience fill in the blanks as far as the quality. So, because once you release something, it's like, it's going to go out there and compete with everything else in the world. And I'm not going to be following it around to make excuses for it. Like, oh, I didn't have enough budget. So, whatever medium I decide to release it in, I've got to make sure that there's no apologies required for you to enjoy it. So, it just hit me. I was like, oh my gosh, if I make a silent film, this is great. I can put all of our music and I get to do some film score work and type of, get to do some experimentation musically that I normally don't get to do on records. I get to, you know, so it was exciting for me as an artist, but also at the same time, I was like, if I do this like a silent film, and silent films, there's not a lot of camera movement, especially in the 1920s. And a lot of the props are two-dimensional. It's like, oh my gosh, we can make this whole thing for like nothing.
Yeah.
If I can convince my friends to make it with me. Because it's in a weird way, like, you might not get that sense when you're watching it. It's a lot like a home movie. We didn't take that long to shoot it. Mm-hmm. Sorry, my microphone just randomly shut off. I had a power plug.
Oh, that's all right.
Sorry, and you're like, where'd he go? Neil just...
I was like, the last Neil.
Okay, yeah. Okay, so that might happen again. We don't know. There's a little storming outside. Okay, so yeah. So anyway, I had to convince my friends to do it, but then the movie was all post-production because I did a lot of the visual effects. I had a visual effects supervisor. His name's Pete Mitchell. He took out all the green screens, did all the cleanup on that.
Yeah.
Did some of the 3D work and animation, did some 2D animation. And then I did almost all the backgrounds you see and a lot of those special effects. So I had to do that and score it at the same time. So we decided to release it episodically. And that way we could kind of like experiment with it and then go run back over the whole thing again and make it one coherent piece.
Yeah.
So I just, because I don't want people waiting for long. They get so edgy about that. Like people are like, what's your new music coming out? All the time. So it's like, if I give people like more than 3 months without music, they start worrying. We did like that, released it episodically, and it had to be told visually. I love that era. I love silent films, but I don't think that if we made an honest silent film, like just like a silent film from back then, mm-hmm. that it would hold up in these times. You know, there's visual elements. Like the movie Metropolis is brilliant. Like, I don't know if you've seen it.
I have not. No.
1927. Metropolis is absolutely beautiful. But there's still something about watching it now with like a, you know, not a live score underneath it, and it and reading a lot of these, you know, dialogue slates that come up. It feels like cute, but not like something I can actually get emotionally involved in now. Like I can be impressed with elements of it. So we were going to make one that appealed to more of modern sensibility, that we were going to limit the amount of dialogue as much as we could.
Yeah.
To keep the movie moving along and to really fairy tale it up, to make sure the movie was rich and that the scenes were rich. And there's always a little mysterious element that the audience always had questions that the story was propelling forward. So it's kind of a hybrid. I mean, at any given scene, you can look at it and it might look like a film from the 1920s, but when you watch the whole thing, I think it hopefully comes across in a way that's more engaging to a modern audience.
I think it does. I think it bridges the you know, the silent film to modern film very well. And so it starts off with a young boy, and you see he's with his father, who's played by you, I believe.
It was one of the last things we shot. I got fat and happy to play the older version of myself.
Right, yeah. Then you dyed your hair and lost some weight, right? You said that in the director's commentary. Yep, that must have been, man, that must have been hard. I don't know. I've been trying to lose weight for a while, but anyway, so it shows his mother's grave, and then his father puts him to bed, and then he sees, he wakes up and he sees this ghostly figure outside, and he follows this figure, and it turns out to be a young girl picking flowers. And then it kind of culminates with them on a mountain by a tree. So reminiscent of Genesis. And then what was interesting to me in that scene where she says, you can see me. Well, you must have had some tragic thing happen. And he says he lost his mother. And then she gives him a gift. And it's a Capricorn scale. And
yes.
He doesn't say thank you. He says... these aren't supposed to be real, you know, which
right, yeah, yeah.
That was just striking admit. To me that he's like, there's no gratitude. It was already the skepticism, you know,
you just gave me a fake gift.
Yeah. Yeah. It was, I'm like, oh yeah, he was not very grateful. And then he proceeds to further not listen to her when she says, you need to leave now because I need to do this thing that'll break your brain if you see me.
Yeah.
So, right. Yeah. And then he kind of has this fall, you know, where he sees her unveil and go to the moon and he falls in love with her. And you have a song that's called Falling Upwards into Love, which I think is reminiscent, or, you know, it ties to that.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then from there, it's him when he's an adult and his, you know, he's very successful and he's going to, you know, have this web of electricity that unites everyone together. And if you don't mind, I have a couple songs. We won't play the whole thing. I'll just play the beginning of Babylon, if you don't mind.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. Hopefully the recording, I tested it out earlier. It sounds pretty good. So, but my recording equipment audience, my recording equipment, I might not do it justice. So go listen to it yourself.
Yeah.
But I'll try here.
Yeah, for sure. Let's check it out.
Tallest tower, and he would ascend, mountain of Vader sight throughout the land. His power was perfected in this temple he erected. No forever insurrection could be crushed beneath his hand, and with his mighty voice he would amend this riddle so we could not comprehend.
That was a taste of Babylon. So yeah, that was, so it was, is that song part of the official movie or no?
No, I thought about putting it in the film, but I had, there's a bunch of songs on the soundtrack that aren't in the final film. They were like credit songs in the episodes when we released like episodes in those, you know, 12 minute
like
episodes.
The airship one.
Yeah, so the airship one, but that actually found its way into the film.
Yes, I noticed that when I watched the theatrical release. It was like, oh yeah, that, because it played at the end. I'm like, oh, I want more of that song. Where's that one? You know, and then you put it in the actual movie, and I liked that a lot. So that was cool. Well,
there were two songs added that were like backstory songs. So yeah. Really, Babylon should be the second song on the album chronologically, but it's not. But it's Penelope Graves should come before that. But yes.
That song is haunting, man.
Oh, thanks, man. So, so Babylon is doing really well. It's got that little bit of that vaudevillian kind of feel to it. And I like that excuse to do that. Those songs have done well for us, too.
Yeah.
But again, I love the Tower of Babel story. I think that pattern is always, you know, whenever there's someone who's pulling the world together beneath them in like a small G God-like way, and there's a tower involved that's going to bring together that
bad stuff's going to happen.
So there's something about Oliver Graves where he's a kind of a strange tyrant in the sense that, you know, he's not this explicit person like bringing order against everyone's will.
Right.
He's got a shadow hierarchy at work, meaning that he's doing all these things, but there's a secret reason behind it. So, he really looks like, to the world, he looks like a hero and a savior. But meanwhile, he's not aiming for them at all. He's aiming for something much higher, something that's above his station.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. And in the film, he is, he's getting money to build his power web so he can supply, ostensibly so he can supply the city with electricity. And this theme of spiders and webs and, you know, they all kind of emerge here and there. But what he's really doing, and I don't want to spoil it, so everybody go watch it before you keep listening. But we're going to spoil things. He's building a rocket ship so he can go to the moon. And he can propose his, you know, to the moon girl that he met when he was a child. And the only person who really knows about this, I think, is the human girl who likes him, Freya.
Yes.
I think she's the only one who, in the director's commentary, you kept commenting on how good an actress she was, and she is a phenomenal actress, because you pretty much get what she's thinking without her having to say anything, which is really, really amazing. So she, when he's blasting off in the rocket, she knows exactly what he's done and what will happen after this point. And, and everyone in the city dies, including her. Like, so he... And she, you could tell by the look on her face that she knows what is about to happen. And so he goes and he wants to marry the Moon Queen, which is insane. Right? Like, why does he think he can do that? And so he, it started out as an act of disobedience, right? Where he refused to listen to the moon girl when she told him, you can't look at what I'm about to do. And he didn't listen, right? So he, you have like tons of symbolism in here.
The symbolism. Like, so you're touching on a few things like this word mentioned. So, I mean, it's not a really that clever of a phrase, but my internal way I speak about it with everybody I worked with was like we're making a four-dimensional story, mm-hmm. meaning that the story itself has a pattern. It's a pattern that you could see in yourself internally, like the idea of when you aim too high and you don't take proper care of your body, when right. you're aiming for something that doesn't actually make you whole and come together as like a civilization within yourself.
Right.
You can see that pattern play out in the world all the time with technocrats and people who have like, oh, they've invented this technology that's going to save us, but really there's an ulterior motive behind it. So we see these patterns all the time. But then what I do after that is that I want to tell that story in every position of the story I can, whether it's in the character's naming, whether it's in the objects that appear in the room, whether it's their costume elements, whether it's the brooches they wear in the film,
right.
Are they standing on the left or the right in this shot? Where's the angle of the sun? Like literally every aspect of the story is because most of it's really like an animated film with live actors that you have to pick what you put in the frame. So if you understand, like if once you tell the story and once you have the story, once you understand it symbolically, now you can start to drive those elements into every aspect of the story. Naming is one. Like, so I do a bunch of tricky things. Like you mentioned Freya.
Yeah.
Her name is Freya Fair, and the word fair is spelled like the old English fairy.
Okay.
Right. So there's that trick in there. And then also the name Freya means the lady in Norse. But at the same time, the day of the week, Friday, is named after Freya,
right.
Pronounced right. So Friday is Freya's day. And in the 1920s, a girl assistant who was like your secretary and kept you organized and was like your personal assistant was a girl Friday.
So I
did what's like every name has two reasons the character is that name. That's one of the things you have to name characters. And then I try to throw some surprises in there. Meaning that I don't use the same convention to name every character.
Right.
I use like McTavish is one of his other, like, so he, like Oliver really consists of three parts in person. Is that Freya, is his, you know, right hand man, but even though she's a woman, and then McTavish is like his left hand, his protector and justice and the one who goes out and does things for him.
Right.
And McTavish, though, the name Tavish is Thomas, which Thomas means twin. We could see that like if Oliver could embody some of this, like the fact that McTavish is actually living in the moment, he's not living in some far off world. If like he could be both of these things at the same time, he would be more whole. And that if he would stop looking up and he could look down and see Freya, that he would be more whole. So we have all these aspects in the story all the way to like these two bankers that appear, and one Prue, and his full name is Prue Denton, and the other one's named Lucretius. And Lucretius is, I mean, again, with the double naming thing, he's a Greek philosopher.
Right.
A lot of his ideas actually led to modern materialism, but also the word lucrative should come to mind when you hear Lucretius.
I got both of those, and then prudent, and also prudish. He's prudish.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so in my story, you can see what's happening. It's a problem in the modern world where prudence is beat down by this desire for acquisition.
Right.
Right. So this is the relationship. So there's this yin yang. There's this tango that's always going on in the world of finance between risk and reward,
right?
Opportunity and fear of loss. So those characters embody that idea. So at every point in the story, not only do you have characters that are functioning in the story, but they're also functioning symbolically as they would in the world and as they should in the story. So and Oliver Graves, like that name, like the main character is Oliver Graves. Like it's funny like how things, you know, because you have a story and you're looking for a name, right? And so I go into the world with that question in mind. Like I'm all these things I want to find things for. And then eventually something will pop up. My kids were reading their yearbook and they mentioned a kid's name, Oliver Graves. And I was like, oh my gosh, that sounds like all of our graves. That's the perfect name.
Yeah.
And also I knew what Oliver meant. And it actually starts as a Nordic name. It's a generic name, like the name Barabbas is in the Bible, like son of father. It's a name like that. It means like the ancestor of your descendant of your ancestor. And so there was something like it had an any man quality to it, but at the same time it had this resonance when you said it out loud, where it's like the city's future is Oliver Graves.
Right. Yes.
Right. So it didn't take me long to come up with those. And I had some people who were working on the script with me that, like, I sent them out. I was like, you just throw like 30 different ideas at me here and I'll see if one sparks something. Yeah. But that wasn't one of those ideas. But so we kind of teamed up and did that. But yeah, I wanted every aspect of the story, every word, every little thing that appeared to be participating in the story. Nothing was arbitrary or disconnected.
Yeah, that's the best way to tell a story, I think, is everything is participatory, but at the same time, it doesn't close it off. You know, it leaves it so that the world seems bigger than what the story is, than what's actually contained in the story, right? Because I think a lot of a trap that a lot of modern authors fall into is they will, everything has to tie into the hero, you know, like, oh, well, this character you met in the beginning of this 6-volume series is actually your long lost twin or whatever, you know, something like that, where it actually makes the world seem smaller.
It's a little too convenient sometimes. I remember it was one of the Spider-Mans that I think it was the one with Andrew Garfield, where it was like the guy he saved in the beginning happened to be the guy who saved him on a crane later in the movie.
Yes. Yeah. Spider-Man, let's get your cranes up. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And like, to work for the villain. And it was like in the city of 18 million people.
Yeah.
Like the entire story converged at around, you know, 3 characters.
Exactly. Yeah. That's not how you do that well, I don't think, you know.
Right.
It's got to be realistic. It's got to be
if you were. But because I mean, realism is an enemy too.
Yeah.
Like I think this is like, you know, part of the downside of Dostoevsky, if you will, is this sort of realism has like a tendency to meander, and realism it's a little horizontal for me in the sense where it's more about like person to person psychology instead of like it loses that parabolic ability to be about like you can take what's happening in that story and you can expand it to be about an entire civilization or an era or a moment in your life when you're deciding what to get at a buffet. Like these things, like they can scale up and down if your goal at the end of the day isn't necessarily like hyper realism and making it feel realistic, because I think you lose you give up some of what a story can be for the sake of it being believable in real life.
Yeah. And I don't like those. I mean, I'm not going to diss on Dostoevsky or anything, obviously not, but,
you can get canceled, hate mail.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe not nowadays. Maybe I'll get praised for disliking Dostoevsky.
No, he's brilliant. But I think that what people did with what he wrote in some other novelizations, novel approaches, the kind of like made fairy tales seem arbitrary and like escapism.
Yeah.
And I think that was a mistake. I think that was just a modern glitch.
Well, I think I think you know Nicholas Kotar.
Oh yeah, love Nicky.
Yeah, he said once that all of those Russian authors, they knew their fairy tales very, very well, and that's kind of how they, you know, that's in the background of their minds, you know, were these fairy stories, the Russian fairy tales and stuff. So I think they're. I don't want to claim that Dostoevsky's built off of fairy tales, but I think they're not disconnected, you know. But I think that when we get these stories, you know, in the modern world, we're not looking at the whole thing. We're just looking at the end result of like a Dostoevsky novel, right? So we don't get like the whole picture, the whole culture, you know. I don't know. That's just a theory that he thought that I thought was really interesting. Realism is a problem because like the people take that to be quote unquote real literature, right? Like that's the
highest form,
right? The highest form of literature when there are no spectral moon girls or transmorgifying moon queens or, you know, like spider-headed people.
yeah come on people, get with the program.
That's realism, man. I see that every day, you know.
Yeah, but like, I mean, so it, like there's like a meta way things could be true. So one of the things fairy tales have this arresting quality, and it has this I mean, like the culture treats it almost like the stories are drunk. And I actually, like, I can make that work because if you think about how alcohol functions, alcohol fermentation is taking a lot of time and condensing it, right? So you take something that takes a long period of time and you condense it and you have this ecstatic experience when it's all presented at once. Like, I mean, this is what an animal does. Like, the world is filled with things like, you know, in the Bible, like knowledge and meaning are equivalent to nutrition in a way. Like, there's a way in which we could see what nutrition does to our body is what, you know, knowledge does to our mind when we receive understanding. And there's this way that animals go out in the world and they eat all this kind of stuff that we can't eat. We can't get enough knowledge out of it, right? We can't get enough nutrition out of it. And it gets condensed into the animal, and then we eat the animal and we get all of the stuff it's collected for us. And this is the same thing with wine, and this is what good stories do, and this is what happens sometimes when you focus on realism, like in a cop drama or a mafia story. Like, they can be really cool stories, but they give up. But sometimes people inadvertently give up this capacity to have a character or a pattern in the story be a condensation of something that happens in the real world. Like, right. So, you know, part of I give all kinds of examples, but like one that I give like this is like when you have kids, you make them brush their teeth at night because if they don't brush their teeth at night, their teeth are going to fall apart, but not that night, you know, so the kids can't tell. They can't project the pattern out far enough. They haven't lived long enough. They're just going to have to trust you on it. And so you force them. So it's going to be a struggle for a long time to get them to brush their teeth and to get them to do it with care and properly. Because if they don't, their teeth will go to hell eventually. Right. You know what I mean? So this kind of idea is lost. So this stories, like really good stories, do this. They condense things that take you too long to see into a small moment. And I think that is so important. And that's something that's just lost in like kind of the, you know, romantic comedies, drama world, novelization of things.
Right.
It's like, no. Like, I mean, really the story's too small. It's too horizontal. It's too flat. It's just about human interactions, realistic human interactions in a realistic world, when it could actually be about so much more. It could make you so much wiser and not even in a way that where you really get it, like it's explained to you, but in the sense where you kind of get the gist of it, you get it implicitly through the story.
Yeah, you intuit it. And I think fairy tales help you intuit things on a sub-rational level. I think that's what they're, I don't want to say that's what their use is, because I don't think fairy tales have a use, not in like a utilitarian way anyway, but they tend to embed patterns like subconsciously, I think, where you can kind of intuit things, and then if you think about them, you can kind of, you know, provide a rational explanation for it, but They're not like rational stories, you know, like not in any way we'd recognize without help.
I think it's more realistic though in the end, because what happens is, I mean, it's more true to reality. I could say it that way instead of realistic, because in reality, you never know enough about anything. You never know everything about anything. You just don't.
Right.
And so when you encounter, let's just say it in a fairy tale, you're like literally encountering a fairy in the myth, right? And you encounter this fairy, and we're not sure if it's going to go well or not for the person who encountered the fairy. Like there might be a way to engage this fairy, which would mean that things are going to go well, and there might be a way to engage the fairy in which it's a problem. And you know, and the fact that the forest and places like this represent these kind of things is the idea that like we have an unknown space in our life, right? Yeah. There are things like everything that could destroy us or could help us, that change, like that's already not a part of us, is outside of us. And you have to have some sort of like, I guess, improvisational skill in which to engage new things in the world in a way that to gauge them intelligently. Right. And so fairy tales do. I mean, like, I understand why you don't want to give them like, oh, they're not, the author's goal is not utility. Like, it's not to pass over, to pass across some sort of platitude or something like that at the end of the day, or some kind of moral. But it does have a conditioning effect on the reader in the sense where it's like, now you're more aware, you're more open-minded, you're more open-eyed.
Right.
You know, about
and that's what I mean.
The potential of things that are out there. So I think that's, those are important things because our world is very, very, very left brain, meaning that we all have our own tradition and we defend it.
Yeah.
Irrationally sometimes, right? And to a point. And some things are worth defending, but they've got to also, they've got to be tested. They've got to be, you know, there has to be a process to engaging those things. But there also has to be a way, like in the story of Jack and the Beanstalk is like a good example, like of a little tiny fairy tale of, you know, really that story is almost like about story creation in a way, in the sense where there's a problem, like they're poor and, you know, what better metaphor for a for your own imagination than a castle in the clouds?
Yeah.
Right. Or a better presentation of that. It's like, oh, so in my imagination, I go on a journey, and in your imagination, you might pull back something bad. You might bring in something that makes it worse, or you might bring in the thing that saves the day, right? As you try to solve your problem and try to find your way out. So I think it's a wonderful story about, like, you know, how an artist creates in the sense that, you know, these magic beans like seeds.
Right.
Take him up into his imagination, and he escapes narrowly without the giants following back home. And so these stories like give you the sense, and like they should give you some sort of courage to, or reminder that you might not be enough as you are, right?
Right.
And that, but to try to become more is dangerous because you might ruin something that was already working fine. You might bring in something that's a contagion, that's parasitic. You know, but
right.
Also you might bring in the thing that, you know, that your heritage is blessed with and your legacy is blessed with and your children are blessed with for years to come. So I think it's way better than like, for me personally, I think that's way more useful than like a story where I'm like, man, they nailed the human psychology.
Right, right. Well, with your Jack and the Beanstalk example, having it be the imagination, at the end he has to cut down the beanstalk, right? So
yeah,
he has
yeah.
to sever his own imagination to save himself from the things that he brought upon himself, right? Like that's really interesting. I've never thought of it like that before, but he's got to ground himself,
yeah,
and then cut his imagination off.
Right. It's the same reason that you're as they've discovered, your left and right hemisphere don't cooperate very easily. They're actually inhibited from cooperating too much.
Yeah.
Like your, you know, the line that runs down the center of your, what is it called? Not cerebral cortex. Is that what it's called? I don't know. I'm not a brain doctor. I probably just offended a lot of people by even talking about.
I have a number of brain doctors who listen to this. No, I don't. I have no idea.
So I'm just gonna
mostly my audience is neurosurgeons.
Neurosurgeons. Okay, great. They can correct me in the comments. So that is, that's kind of a neat thing. But
yeah,
when I look at these stories, I mean, this is part of the problem too, though, for me. Like, I feel like certain people are wired different ways and see things different ways. I feel like the meaning of stories like that are just, they feel fairly obvious to me.
Yeah.
So I'm never sure, like, when I'm passing some of these things on in a story, this is why I think it's important, like what I was trying to do in Queen of the Night, at least, where I'm trying to tell the story on every level possible, because there's no way people, like, there's certain symbolism that is going to remain opaque to people.
Yeah.
Like, especially, I think, especially with the moon and the moon girls, because
yes,
their function in the story is as an enigma. So they have a coherent pattern, but it's not a necessarily human pattern.
Right.
So people are trying to anthropomorphize them in the story. They'll confuse themselves, which is great, because that's what I hope they do, because they are the enigma. Like, he is engaging the enigma, like you in Lovecraft, like this is part of the thing. It's like you go beyond the edges of what's your peripheral vision. You step into the blur,
mm-hmm,
of the world, and you try to step out into this thing, and like, and you can't name what came for you, like the dread that you weren't prepared for. You can't
right.
name it. You can't describe it properly. And I think that's the right way to discuss those kind of things. So yeah, there's going to be aspects of the story that, you know, you can try, someone could probably crack the code on what's really going on, but at the same time, it wouldn't benefit you because they are the riddle.
Right.
Right. And function as a riddle in the story.
Well, I definitely picked up some of the patterns, but like you said, I haven't figured it out yet. But one thing that I really think is worth talking about, the whole thing's worth talking about, but is the role of Oliver's mother, Penelope
yeah.
Graves. And I'm going to play, if you're cool with it, I'm going to play the beginning of Penelope Graves, the song.
Yes. Okay.
So here we go.
The faintest star slips out of sight, though she won't go quietly into the night, and breaks from her course, intending to fall, and runs across the sea by the edge she's been called. She dashed toward the shore in the dark of no moon. The sand is the altar, the land is her groom. But alas, when her feet came to meet the dry ground, a jilting betrayal as her heels settled down. And her name drifted.
Yeah.
Penelope Graves.
Yep. So his mother is only mentioned twice, I think, in the film. And this can be the last thing we talk about because it's kind of running short on time. But you mentioned his mother twice. And once in the beginning where he and his father are looking at her grave. And then and then at the end, before Oliver gets in this rocket ship, he visits his father who is dying. And he says, you need to marry a girl, you know, make sure you marry a girl. And he's like, oh, I have one in mind. And he looks up at the moon and then he asks, what is she like? And he says, unearthly. I think that's what he said. Unearthly, I think.
Yeah.
And then he says, that reminds me, or that's how I describe your mother. I can't remember what he says, but something like that, where it's like, yes, that's how I viewed your mother, too. And in this song, what's going on here?
Okay, yeah. So, I mean, I'll tell the story quickly. Yeah, so
it's really, really cool.
Again, so again, like in that Tolkien sense, like I'm doing soft world building, not hard world building.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so hard world building is the idea that, well, I think we know the difference. Lord of the Rings would be hard world building.
Yeah.
Like a Miyazaki story, like Spirited Away might be a good example. That's soft world building.
Right.
Where it's not a lot of it's explained, but it seems to be everybody in the world seems to know how it works.
Right.
And also, like, there's other versions of that. Like, Christopher Nolan does this pretty well, like, because he's dealing with this technology in the movie Inception, which is like, how exactly does this technology work that allows us to go into people's dreams? Well, the movie begins, we're already using it.
Right. Yeah.
So don't have to answer those questions because you're seeing it working. That's how you're introduced to it.
Right.
So, he saves himself a lot of trouble doing that. So I can't just have, you know, as soon as I started to thought about the story, I was like, well, the mother's going to have a backstory and I'm going to hint to that in the film. And then I'm going to give the diehard fans who want the soundtrack and want to get the mother's backstory, I'm going to put that in the song and it's going to be a little mini standalone fairy tale. So in the fairy tale, like in the constellation Capricorn, which is the faintest constellation. It only appears in the sky, you know, in the northern hemisphere for like 2 months, I think, where it's visible.
Hmm.
And then it dips back down. And so, you know, this one star, she decides that, you know what, I'm tired of spending most of my life down here, like beneath the surface, and all the other stars are up here. And I'm going to, like, this year when I touch the horizon, so it's like this flat Earth cosmology in the story, I'm going to step off. And I'm going to walk and explore. And so she jumps off onto the water and she runs across the water. But when she gets to land, when her feet hit the dry ground, there's a jilting betrayal, right? So right. She feels like, so she's like more akin to the water and the stars and the land is like her groom. So, I mean, people wonder sometimes when they look backwards, like how did mythology function? Where do people come up with these ideas? Or like, so an idea like this, that she couldn't walk on ground, is not just a random fairy tale idea. It's based upon your phenomenological experience of the world, where if you look at a placid lake and you look at the stars, you can see the stars reflecting the water. There's an empathy between what appears in the night sky and the waters. So for example, I'll give you one of those empathy. It's like, so the stars is like, so during the day we have one light, one great light, and the sky is opaque.
Mm-hmm.
We can't see through it. And then below we have multiplicity, meaning that you can name things, you can see things, you won't fall in holes, you can get around more easily, you can properly identify the millions and millions and millions of things that you'll see around you. But when that veil lifts, when there's not that unity above, right, that there's multiplicity, then there's darkness below. So unity, multiplicity flip. When there's the multiplicity is above, that means the earth below becomes one opaque, dark thing. Okay, so the sea has that in common with the sky in the sense that there's these waves above and darkness below. There's lots of commonalities behind this. I could probably talk about it for an hour. I won't. So but as an ancient person, you're looking at this and like, so it would make sense that a star could walk on the water because it does.
Right.
Right. But do they walk on land? No, they do not. They do not walk on land. Okay. So, so because his mother's a star, right? She's, she can't walk on land, but so she gives up her flight, right? She takes her wings and she forms herself shoes and she weaves herself a pair of shoes. Now, if you look at the etymology of the name Penelope,
right, it
means weaver. Yep. And Penelope also has a role in the Odyssey.
Yep.
Homer's Odyssey, right? Is that Homer? Oh my gosh.
Yes, Homer. Yep.
Yeah. Of course. Why would I second guess myself? yeah, he's the Aeneid. I always get confused by.
Right.
Anyway, the, you know, so she makes these things and she, her eventually, eventually she runs out of silk, they wear out and her feet begin to bleed and like cut her as she walks on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, there's this coming of age part of the story. So a lot of these stories, like when it has to do with pricking your finger and falling asleep or eating a red apple and falling asleep for these girls coming of age, it is, it's telling a story that we witness in the world, is that there is a way that, that masculinity can bring revelation to a cycle, to end a cycle.
Right.
Well, and so, you know, bloody bandages, feet bleeding, she's trapped, she's immobilized. And then Huxley Graves finds her. So the name Huxley means cursed field. That's, you know, it's one of those names that actually, you know, it's one of those ironic names, like Lorelei is one of those names where it's like, oh, you're a siren that lures people to their cliffs and screams like a banshee. it's like, so sometimes parents give their kids names and they're actually, pretty dark.
Right.
Huxley would be one of those. So, but Huxley finds her in a field, right? But, you know, so this is the origin story of Oliver Graves, that his mother is a star,
right?
That when the moon girl's there for a reason after her mother died, she's collecting things. The Capricorn scale, he's actually sharing the mother. She realizes that he's had a great tragedy because he can only see her if he was a little bit like her. So, this is more than I normally give away to people, but I just want to give people a little taste of like, you know, like how fairy tales function or how stories can function. In a way that's like coherent, but maybe implicit to an audience, like it's only implied, and so that I didn't want to feel like the Capricorn scale was just what they call in script writing a MacGuffin,
right?
You know, it's just a random, like, so Alfred Hitchcock would use MacGuffins. The MacGuffin was just like microfilm in a spy movie, right? It's like the microfilm. We don't know what's on the microfilm. It means nothing to us at home.
The Maltese Falcon.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah,
it means nothing to us at home. And then George Lucas, like, took the idea. He would take the idea of the MacGuffin and make it be the plot point at the end. Like, it was actually the thing that drove us forward was the thing that was needed at the end of the film.
Yeah.
So that was his version. My version is kind of in the middle. Like, the MacGuffin is the thing we needed for the middle of the film. So, the Capricorn scale is that. But the Capricorn, like, I mean, look up a Capricorn. It's the union of all things on the earth. It's the animal that lives at the top of the mountain and the animal that lives at the bottom of the sea combined. And so you can realize what she gave him was, you know, anything but a right to go to the moon.
Right?
She gave him government over the earth. So all of these things, like, I mean, I feel like I'm saying too much, but I don't know. Maybe this is interesting to your audience because I normally don't like to give away that much of what I'm talking about. But at the same time, I want people to know that it's like, it's not, these aren't just arbitrary things, like, because what happens with fairy tales now, everybody wears it like a costume. It's like, oh, dragons look cool. Wouldn't it be cool if a dragon was like a pet? It's like, it's not a dragon anymore. It's like, oh, wouldn't it be cool if the ogre became king? It's like, that would be a terrible king.
Right.
Like the ogre, like the fact that he would remain an ogre and be king would be devastation for that kingdom, because you have a hermit character. You have a thing that represents the thing that doesn't care about anyone else and dwells in the edges.
Right.
So, like, why would you want a king that has like the opposite of kingly character? So, like, these patterns that appear in these modern stories, are they just pick up fairy tale stuff and wear like a suit instead of making it actually participate in that language? And so,
right.
I guess that's why some of this is worth discussing as we maybe hopefully move back towards a world that doesn't just think, you know, fairy tale characters look cool or sound cool, like that they actually can understand that it's actually participating in a way the world reveals itself to us.
Right. Well, that's it. I think Jonathan Pageau has said these things are not arbitrary, right? So one of my favorite clips from him is his critique of Neil Gaiman, the fantasy author. And that's one of I watched that clip. It's like a 6-minute clip. I watched it like 5 or 6 times. And he just gets it so right. Is it Neil Gaiman? What prevents Neil Gaiman from being an amazing fantasy writer? Like, he's a pretty good fantasy writer, but what prevents him from being an amazing one is that he denies that that the categories he uses are real, like, entities, you know, that have a purpose. Mm-hmm. And he just, you know, they're just arbitrary, you know. They're just like, I think the example he gives is that the Lord of Dreams is just some guy who happens to be the Lord of Dreams, and he doesn't actually embody what that really means. He could stop whatever he wants. You know, it's like, well, if you stop being the Lord of Dreams, you're not the Lord of Dreams anymore. You know?
Yeah.
So I think that's what I don't hate Neil Gaiman. Like, I don't like other authors like George R. R. Martin. I don't like George R. R. Martin, but Neil Gaiman, I think he falls short a lot because he doesn't like, go that he doesn't take the plunge and say, yes, there is an inherent meaning to the cosmos, you know.
Yeah but he's got skills that are good enough that he transcends his flaws. So
Edgar, yeah, for sure, I think,
like a Neil Gaiman, not that they are doing the same work, but Edgar Allan Poe was a pretty crap poet. Okay? Like, I'm just gonna say it. Like, I don't know if there's really people that disagree with me out there. I haven't looked this up, but it just seems to me, as far as poetry goes, not that good. But like the ability to involve us in the nightmare, like in the hellscape, right? Like the ability to have the right thing to aim at would kind of transcend that and the dread of it. And so he had a place in this world. And so Neil Gaiman really gets right, like in American Gods, like the idea that, oh, these gods exist by our attention.
Right.
And people giving them attention and then gaining attention. That's how they, because they really can't act in the world on their own. They have to get people to act for them because the world is not theirs. And I think he gets that very, very right. You know, but so Neil Gaiman has this, he undercuts himself, I think, with what Jonathan's talking about. I think the reason that, I mean, I think that he excels over other authors today in this category, mm-hmm. or because it's kind of like winning the battle of the world's tallest short person. you know, I think that's part of the reason why I'm not dissing him. I think he's a wonderful writer.
I appreciate him. Yeah.
You know, but at the same time, so there's something people do, and maybe this is a good thing to leave off on, because you don't want to catch yourself doing this, especially if you're someone who, like, you know, I might believe in fairies. You want to really believe in fairies? You know, we can talk about this. So one of the things, the words people use, I think Jonathan talks about this too, but I might use it in a different way, is they'll tag the word just into things. Well, it's just this, or it's just that. And they don't realize, like, what that word, how that word functions symbolically. The word just turns things into water. It turns whatever idea you were talking about or whatever idea has been presented, right, as if it's something you can't build on because it's not real. It's not solid ground.
Right. Yeah.
It's not. But at the same time, a lot of things people say just about are things that we do experience and we can discuss and we can talk about like they're real. And we do, they do have a commonality from one person to the next to understand them. So I think that that's, Neil Gaiman kind of adjusts himself sometimes. This, or this is just this. And what they don't realize they're doing is like, oh, you built the thing. And then because of materialism, like because of some modern thought pattern, you reduced it to just being a concept, to just being a construct. Mm-hmm. And that's like, that's taking something that was solid, something that we could interact with, and turning it into water, something that we can't hold in our hands anymore. And so I think he's made a terrible mistake. I think Neil Gaiman would do himself in every capacity better to be like, no, what I'm talking about is real.
Right.
Like you might, you're right. What I'm talking about is totally real. I think it might be more real than how you perceive the laws of physics. Like, I mean, he would he would have a cooler brand.
Oh, and, yeah.
And there'd be better takeaways from his work that you could actually, like, you could be wiser for the reading, not just entertained.
Right. Oh, I agree. Yeah. Fantastic. Well, yeah, I think we are almost out of time. Sure. Well, I have one more question for you. And if you have been listening to the show, you probably know what's going to happen. But this show is called I Might Believe in Fairies. And yes. I probably do believe in fairies now at this point, but whatever. It's for the gimmick of the show. I'm agnostic of the existence of fairies. But what I want to know, Neil deGrade, one of the lead singers of Dirt Poor Robins, do you believe in fairies?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
All right.
I can describe how. So I can describe a pattern that I think people can understand how they exist. So angels are often associated with virtues, like that. Like there's some commonality in certain languages with the etymology of what an angel is, and you know. But also there's this idea in Christianity that angels, that demons can come as angels of light, like as a trick, but try to trick you, you know. But angels don't lie and demons do is one of the differences. So there's this idea in a story when you encounter a fairy in you're in the woods and you're in the unexplored places, and a fairy can appear ambivalent, like it's not good or evil at first, or you don't know which way it's going to turn. Mm-hmm. But it's like a misunderstood virtue. It's like a virtue you need to come to terms with in your own life. So what they're talking about in fairy tales and the way people step forward and interact with fairies is absolutely something that you do all the time. If you're going to grow in character, if you're going to grow in wisdom, like you have to understand how to incorporate more and more of the unknown into yourself in a way that doesn't corrupt you, that doesn't ruin you, that makes you stronger and feeds your soul. So I see fairies all the time. And not just that, I'd say that the other way I see fairies is not in a like strictly old school Greek way where like the tree contained the spirit.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you can see. So here's an example I give. Like if you walk with your kids in the forest one day, you can ask the kids like, hey, what's your favorite tree? Or you can ask them, that, and they'll give you different answers for different reasons of taste. Mm-hmm. Or you can say, which tree is the proudest? And when the discussion actually by asking that question, which sounds like anthropomorphizing, mm-hmm. actually makes a more objective discussion on the beauty of a tree, because now we have to recognize what a tree is trying to do and what it's driven to do.
Right.
And what it has been purposed to do. So when you look at that and you look in the world, you realize like, no, there's like there are dryads and there are nymphs and there are these things. And maybe that's a better way to understand them than me trying to understand the mechanical process and the way it breaks down, because that I can't really understand. But the idea that the tree has a will and a goal is a wonderful way to understand fairies in a practical sense. Now, but they might exist in ways beyond that. But that's just my two practical versions.
Well, that was probably the most unique answer I've gotten so far. So thank you. That was awesome. Well, thank you for coming on the show, Neil deGrade. This has been fun. This is I've been looking forward to this for about a week, and I'm glad I can be healthy enough to actually carry on a conversation for more than 5 minutes.
Proud of you. You did it.
I did it. Yeah, that was me on the couch. I was like passing out. I'd be like awake, and I'm like, oh, okay, the kids are in bed. All right, well, I'm gonna fall asleep again, and then I'd wake up. My wife is like cleaning something, and I fall asleep. But it was just this like Twilight Zone weird, you know, thing that was going on. But
perfect.
Well, thanks for coming on my show.
I've been there. You bet, man.
Thank you for listening to this episode of I Might Believe in Fairies. Please leave a rating and review wherever you listen to podcasts. Please follow me on Twitter at Aaron Erber and like me on Facebook. If you're excited to see where the podcast is going and want to offer some support for the project, you can find me on Patreon. Music is by Alexander Nakarada, and podcast art was designed by my wonderful sister-in-law, Linnea Kisby. Until next time, talk to you soon.